a chaos of platforms, flight decks, transmission antennas, and roving machinery studded the hull of the Athorian floating city, but the exposed surfaces were covered with hanging moss. Large trees grew out of special pockets on the side walls, rising to the sky and looking thicker and greener than the metallic towers. On the top flat surface of the disk, greenhouse domes sparkled like 1,000 eyes in the sun. Kwai could see through the transparent domes to dense botanical gardens in carefully manicured rows. Small ships flitted like gnats about the landing ports and shipping bays. Underneath the Tafanda Bay, banks of diffused repulsor lift engines kept the entire city hovering over the treetops, casting an elliptical shadow over the leafy surface. The Athorian city slowly drifted along a wandering course with no destination in particular, without touching the sacred ground. Wedge keyed in his request for landing coordinates and was answered by an odd echoing voice that Kwai thought sounded like someone speaking through a long, empty tube. After a moment, the comm system crackled again with the voice, or was it another one, changing the coordinates? "Excuse us for the oversight, sir. A special representative will meet you at the landing bay. We hope you enjoy your stay here on our homeworld." Wedge looked suspiciously at the comm unit. "Why would they be giving us special treatment?" he said to Kwai. "Nobody is supposed to know who we really are." Kwai looked around, and suddenly the cockpit of the space yacht seemed smaller. "Do you think we're in danger? Should we turn around and find some other place to go?" Wedge looked as if that was indeed what he wanted to do. "No, it's all right," he said bravely. "I can protect you. Don't worry." They landed on the pad indicated, and Wedge extended the passenger ramp. He climbed down the gangway first and reached up to take Kwai by the hand, leading her gently down. She could easily have disembarked by herself, but she enjoyed the attention he showered on her. Surrounding the space yacht were wide, bold, gray-barked trees with low branches that spread out to form a long, flat platform. Brilliant white and blue flowers spangled the leaves. Staring around her, Kwai took a deep breath of the moist air. Everything smelled fresh and alive, filled with a symphony of scents that startled her imagination. "Greetings." Kwai turned to see an exceedingly strange-looking alien hulking toward them, flanked by 2 10-year-old human boys. The hunchbacked alien wore a white cape trimmed with braid. Its head looked like a long ladle, as if someone had taken a face made of soft clay and stretched it into an S-curve, looping the front up and yanking out 2 eye stalks. The mouth was hidden far under the sloping canopy of its head. As Kwai watched, the cumbersome-looking creature took steps forward with a gentle, careful grace. The 2 human boys beside the creature wore similar white capes over bright green jumpsuits. Pale-haired and blue-eyed, both wore beatific expressions, but neither of them spoke. Wedge must have seen how startled Kwai was by the alien's appearance. "I guess I should have warned you. The Athorians are commonly called hammerheads." Kwai nodded slowly, thinking about other strange creatures she had seen, from the fish-faced Admiral Akbar to the tentacle-headed Tal Sivron, who had run Maw installation. Perhaps not all intelligent creatures in the galaxy could be as attractive as some humans, such as Wedge. "Actually," the alien said, stepping closer, "we dislike the name Hammerheads. It seems deprecating to us." "My apologies, sir," Wedge said, bowing slightly. "I am Momo Nadon, and I am honored to be of service to you, Wedge Antilles and Kwaizooks." Wedge took one step back in panic. "How do you know our names?" he said. Momo Nadon made a hollow bubbling sound that came from both sides of his mouth in a stereophonic echo. "Mon Mothma asked me to give you special accommodations." "Why would Mon Mothma tell you we were coming here?" Wedge said. "We're supposed to be keeping a low profile." As Nadon gave a slight bow, his ladle-shaped head seesawed up and down. "I have sympathized with the Rebel Alliance since my days of exile on Tatooine, more than a decade ago. My people banished me to the desert planet, where I could tend the sands rather than our beautiful forests. The Empire had demanded certain agricultural information, and I gave it to them to save our forests from being obliterated. But still my people exiled me. I returned here after the Emperor's death, and I have continued to make amends ever since." Nadon gestured to the two human boys. Take their luggage. We will show them their staterooms. The youths moved in unison without the pell-mell franticness of young boys, entering the space yacht and returning with the slick silvery containers of vacation clothes. Nadon led them away from the landing bay, ducking his head under the low-hanging branches that surrounded the landing pad. The passage seemed like a living green tunnel.
I was also in the cantina in Mos Eisley when Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi first met Captain Solo. I did not know my brush with history at that time, but I remember it clearly, though I was preoccupied with other concerns at the time.
I'm amazed you could recall a meeting like that after so many years, Wedge said. Nadon indicated a disguised turbo lift that opened like a great leafy pod in the wall. They all stepped inside and began to descend deeper within the Tafanda Bay. After a long pause, Nadon finally said,
Ithorians have long memories.
He led them through winding corridors, past small domes that contained specimens of plant life from different parts of the planet. Near a delicately spraying fountain, Nadon pointed to two doors across the corridor from each other.
I have assigned you these staterooms, he said. Please contact me if you desire other amenities. I am here to serve you.
The two mysterious boys deposited the luggage in the corridor and stepped back to stand on either side of Nadon. Kwai finally said,
You haven't introduced us to the children. Are you their caretaker?
Nadon made a rumbling, bubbly sound in his twin throats.
They are seedlings grown from the flesh of my enemy. They are also a memory of my days on Tatooine.
Nadon hung his ladle-shaped head. The two boys remained impassive, and Nadon ushered them off. Without a backward glance, he left Wedge and Kwai standing outside their staterooms, wondering what he meant. After nightfall on the upper observation deck of the Tafanda Bay, Kwai went with Wedge to watch the moons rise. The lavender skies had turned a deep violet, punctuated by brilliant stars in a wash across the heavens. A small moon in full phase climbed over the eastern horizon, while the fingernail crescent of a much larger moon hung close to the western sky, following the brilliant colors of sunset over the edge of the world. High up, two other moons showed swollen quarter phases. Kwai took a deep breath of the humid air, smelling a plethora of spicy perfumes from green plants and night-blooming flowers. Like a complex mixture of all the perfumes and all the pleasant cooking herbs she had ever smelled. The breeze grew paradoxically warmer with nightfall, and she felt her feathery hair drifting about. She straightened it with her slender fingers, knowing that Wedge liked to see her pearly strands glisten in the light. She had changed into a soft wrap swirled with pastel colors that accentuated the ethereal beauty of her wispy body. The Ithorian eco-city cruised slowly over the treetops. The gentle hum of the Tafanda Bay's banks of repulsor lift engines blended with the simmering night sounds of the jungle below. The breeze rustled leaves in the tall hedges and stands of scale trees around the observation deck. Other Ithorians arrived, standing in silence or thrumming in their strange stereo language. Wedge and Kwai said nothing to each other. She stepped closer, brushed against him, then finally let herself snuggle up to his side. Nervously, it seemed, Wedge slipped an arm around her waist, and she, Kwai Zooks, inventor of the Sun Crusher, co-creator of the Death Star, felt honored to be under the protection of General Wedge Antilles. She knew that Imperial loyalists would be desperate to regain the secret knowledge locked in her brain. But Kwai realized that here, at least, she felt completely safe. 26. Jason and Jaina continued their trek across Coruscant's dank underbelly. They couldn't tell if the dim half-light that filtered down from high above signified nighttime or day. The air smelled thick with rotted garbage, dead things, corroded metal, and stagnant water. They walked along the widest streets, dodging rubble, clamoring over fallen and ancient wreckage. They had seen nothing familiar for hours, and neither of them knew what to do next.
I'm hungry, Jaina said.
Me too, Jason said.
The deep underground was smothered in a silence overlaid with white noise. Shadowy creatures, startled by the twins, fled into darker hiding spots. Bumping one pile of debris, Jason and Jaina sparked an avalanche of frightening clatters. The twins ran from the noise, generating further junk falls that tinkled and clanged from great heights.
My feet hurt, Jason said.
Mine don't, Jaina answered. Up ahead, they finally saw a welcome sign. A cave dwelling made of shored-up wreckage, walls built from piled chunks of duricrete mortared together with a paste of dried algae, mud, and darker substances. Smoky lights burned deep inside the cave, looking enticing in contrast to the forbidding bleakness of the undercity. Jason and Jaina moved forward at the same time. Food? Jason asked. His sister nodded. Outside of the strange, slumped cave, they saw cables running through lichen-clogged eye bolts mounted at various points. Along the walls and ceilings, metal bands like long finger bones dangled in a decoration, linked together by sagging segments of chain.
In here, Jaina said, taking the lead.
Dimness folded over them, leading them toward the enticing lights. Near her head, a scratching, scuttling sound came from the shadows. The girl looked to see an elongated spider roach nearly the size of her head. Bumping against her, Jason leaned forward to get a better look at the creature. The spider roach clambered up the lumpy wall and hesitated, turning three glassy amber eyes at them. Suddenly, with a ratcheting clatter, a fistful of metal flanges from the ceiling swung loose like a prehensile mechanical hand dangling on chains. Dozens of steel fingers slammed against the wall to trap the spider roach, clamping it into a makeshift metallic cage. The creature thrashed and flailed, clacking its mandibles. Sparks flew as chitinous forelimbs scrabbled against the impenetrable bars. In panic, Jason and Jaina hurried down the tunnel toward the flickering orange lights. But the twins stopped, simultaneously sensing a thrill of danger. They looked up just in time to see a much larger cage, all prongs and sharp metal edges, collapse down around them. Mechanical metal claws surrounded them like dozens of fists chained together.
Trap! Jaina said.
Shuffling footsteps came toward them, a thud, then a scrape, as a large, hulking creature emerged from the depths of the lair. The silhouette appeared first, a massive, tufted head with enormous arms dragging almost to the ground. One thickly muscled thigh looked the size of a tree trunk, but the other leg was much shorter, twisted and withered. Jason and Jaina rattled the sharp metal edges of the cage, but the mechanical claws grew tighter together like scissors.
Help! Jason said.
Then their captor came into full view, lit from the side by reflected smoky lights. The creature was covered with a pelt of shaggy hair, showing no distinction between its enormous head and the rest of its torso, as if both pieces had been smashed together into one barrel-shaped mass. The thing's mouth hung in a long, crooked slash, twisted sideways and straightened back only partway. Its left eye was overgrown with a mass of tumors and rotting flesh. The other eye, nearly as large as the twins' fists, shone a sickly yellow, streaked with red lines. Jason and Jaina were too afraid to say anything. Their ogre-like captor shambled past, ignoring them for the moment as he rocked back and forth on his stubby, withered leg. He picked up the small trap to inspect the frantic spider roach. The children could smell the stink from the monster as he next bent toward the bars of their cage, thrusting his giant yellow eye close. But Jason and Jaina scrambled to the other side of the cage. The ogre disconnected long chains from the wall, draped them over his shoulder, and dragged the twins' cage clattering down the corridor into his firelit den. The cage rolled and crashed against unseen obstacles, and the twins had to scramble to keep themselves upright. Inside, gnawed bones from large and small creatures cluttered the monster's lair, some piled in baskets, others cracked and strewn over the broken floor. Smoky red flames came from smoldering pots filled with rancid-smelling fat. Chained in a cleared area of the pit sat a tusked, rat-like creature covered with bristling fur. Its black, rubbery lips stretched back in a perpetual snarl. Gobbets of drool flew from its mouth as it snarled and threw itself to the end of its chain. A set of broken manacles from a detention area hung on the spike-encrusted walls of the chamber. As the ogre moved about in the brighter light, tatters of an old prison uniform could be seen among his greasy curls of body hair. The ogre pried open the metal fingers of the small spider roach trap. He picked up the arachnid with his lumpy bare hands and tossed it to the giant rat monster. The glossy spider roach flailed its long legs as it tumbled end over end, and the rat monster snapped it out of the air. But the bug managed to grab onto the rubbery lips with its sharp legs, and it stung hard. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.